I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE in the shadow of Friday's unprecedented Alaska meeting between leaders of Russia and the USA. Away from the prospect of immediate global nuclear destruction is the ongoing NATO nation armed genocide that will continue on tomorrow's so-called World Humanitarian Day. It's a day to pay tribute to health and aid workers killed around the world. Hundreds have been killed by British, EU and American weapons in Gaza just this year, alongside hundreds of journalists and media workers. It was just over a week ago when half a dozen journalists who had been working in Gaza and reporting on the Israeli genocide that we see played out on our TV and phones were targeted and killed by US, UK, EU armed Israeli forces. This is condemnation, and outrage grows around the world while the very countries responsible for the mass murder, malnutrition and starvation publicly pretend to care while privately keeping the war machine pumping. Joining me again from Cambridge, Massachusetts is an internationally recognized Israeli-American genocide scholar who has been condemned for concluding that Israel's actions in Gaza do indeed amount to genocide by definition. Professor Omer Bartov is the Dean Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University. Thank you so much, Professor, for coming back on Going Underground. Last time you came on, you said, and we discussed how difficult it was to quantify the extent of the UK-US EU armed systemic killing. Now you claim beyond reasonable doubt it is a genocide. Why?
Yeah, first, thanks for having me. I basically concluded that by May of 2024 and wrote about it initially in The Guardian that August. And this article that most came out most recently in The New York Times carries that forward to close to the present moment. The reason principally for concluding that this was genocide is that initially when the IDF attacked Gaza in retaliation for the Hamas attack, it proclaimed its policy, its main goal, war goals, to be the destruction of Hamas and the release of the hostages. There were then about 250 hostages. By May that year, it turned out that these were not the main goals of the war. And in fact, that the main goals of the war were what many people in top political and military positions in Israel had said in the immediate aftermath of October 7th, and that was to make Gaza entirely uninhabitable for its population. And the moment that I concluded that was when the IDF ordered about a million people who had congregated in Rafah, in the southernmost city of the Gaza Strip, most of whom had been displaced multiple times, to move out of there to the Mawasi area, the beach area in southwestern Gaza, so as to be able to take over Rafah. Then the IDF moved in and flattened it entirely. By August, it was gone. And that was the last proof one needed to see that this was actually a systematic campaign of destroying everything in Gaza, homes, of which by now about 90% have been destroyed, schools, again, about 90% destroyed, all public buildings, universities, mosques, including also water plants. So everything that makes it possible for a population to live, to study, to maintain its health, and to reconstitute its cultural identity as a group once that violence is over. All of that has been largely destroyed. And the goal may have been to ethnically cleanse the population, but since the Palestinians have no place to go and they are locked in the Gaza Strip, it's become a genocidal campaign.
And what's the reaction, given that you fought in the Israeli defense, Israeli occupation forces yourself? How have you reacted to the reaction to your proclamation that it is genocide?
Look, I mean, there have been various reactions, I would say. Yes, there were people who were very upset with me, and I received a fair amount of communications to that effect. Interestingly, those communications usually did not come up with any rational arguments, but were very emotive. People felt hurt, angry. How is it possible that I can say that the country of Israel, founded after the Holocaust, would be engaged in genocide? So they were very emotional. But I received also a large number of responses, emails, and other sorts of communications, actually thanking me for clearly stating why I thought this was genocide in the most dispassionate and rational and logical manner that I could, because this is what we are seeing. And although it is, of course, a scandal, the scandal is not saying it, but the act itself, that Israel now is engaged in that kind of operation.
And so it's your understanding that the European Holocaust of the 1940s is being weaponized to try and continue and prolong this genocide.
Well, what? Look, I mean,
that's what you said. Israel, in effect.
Correct. So Israel, for many years, certainly since the 1980s, has increasingly taught its own people, but also Europe and the United States, that the Holocaust was not only an event in the past that should be commemorated and memorized and researched, but also an imminent danger, that whenever Israel was under any kind of threat, including by the people that it occupies and oppresses, that might lead to another Auschwitz. And therefore, if you have this kind of mentality, then any sort of attack, and certainly an attack like the one that was conducted by Hamas, is seen as a genocidal attack that could lead to the destruction of the state. And if that is the case, what is the lesson of the Holocaust drawn by Israelis? It is that you have to eradicate that enemy, because otherwise you would be eradicated yourself. So this is one aspect of it. There's another aspect of it, which is that I would say, especially the administrations under Netanyahu have been very good in putting out that message, very effective, is that any criticism of Israel, of Israeli policies, is potentially anti-Semitic, and anti-Semitism can lead to genocide of the Jews, and therefore that one has to avoid any such criticism, lest one be tarnished with allegations of anti-Semitism. And this has been used very effectively in the United States last spring. Many of the protests were shut down under allegations of anti-Semitism, which were false. Also in Germany, there's even a greater sensitivity, I would say, to allegations of anti-Semitism. And so, in a sense, the Holocaust and anti-Semitism are being used both to justify the actions by the IDF and to shut down any protests internationally against these sort of actions.
And indeed, the anti-Semitism slur was used against Bernie Sanders in the United States and successfully against Jeremy Corbyn in Britain, the most popular Labour leader in Western Europe. But if I was back in the BBC, where I once worked, I wouldn't be able to use the word that you're using, genocide. And you might have noticed, I don't know whether it's happened to you when you've used that word on their output, you're not allowed by law in the censorship regulation, same on German, French, and other, and perhaps on US television channels, although the US has the First Amendment. I mean, does that mean the media are becoming complicit in the genocide because you're not allowed to use the word genocide? You'll notice on their headlines, they don't say, as part of the genocide, six journalists have been burned alive in a tent or, you know, similar stories.
Well, look, let me say, I've used the term genocide on American mainstream networks. I've used it on the BBC. I've used it in France, and I've used it in Germany in interviews. So I've used it.
And then
they allow me to do it.
I think they have to get,
you
have to be pushed back on it. What about this killing of journalists? Sorry, go on.
No, I'm just saying I used it, but I want to say that the mainstream media in Europe, in Western Europe, and in the United States, and I'm not talking about Israel, that's a whole other kettle of fish, has been very, very sparing in reporting from Gaza and in showing the reality of what is going on there. It's only most recently, As happened often in the past, when these images of starving children started filtering out of Gaza, that there was a sense of horror, and it says that we must finally cover what's going on there. So for a lot of Europeans and Americans, Gaza became something on the back burner, the last page of the newspaper, the last item of the news, newscast. I think now there's a change. I think there's a change in Germany, and there is beginning, I hope, a change in the United States as well in terms of just reporting to the public what is actually going on there.
And certainly amongst the MAGA base. Yeah, I meant that the presenters and the journalists themselves for these organizations, they're banned from using the word and to push back immediately should a scholar say the dread word. Do you think, given that last time you were saying that you were gathering evidence, as it were, there was a real focus on the slaughter of journalists by Israel to prevent evidence emerging that would back up claims like yours that it is genocide?
Yes, and most of these journalists work for Al Jazeera, of course, because very few other journalists have ever been able to make it into the Gaza Strip, because they're not allowed to enter by the Israeli government, also actually by the Egyptians. Yes, it's clear that there's been a targeting of journalists. There's been a targeting of military installations, of doctors and other aid workers. And all the evidence shows this last killing, of course, the IDF admitted that it killed those journalists intentionally, claiming that one of them was working for Hamas. And maybe he was at some point and maybe he wasn't, but he was working at that time as a journalist. And so there's been a concerted attempt, first of all, to prevent any news from coming out. It's failed. It hasn't succeeded, but it has caused the deaths of between 160 and 200 and something journalists. There's also been a concerted attempt, as was reported by Physicians for Human Rights, Israel branch, just last week, I think, to destroy the entire medical service. A deliberate attempt. This is not, incidental damage, but a deliberate attempt. So what you're seeing is exactly an attempt to kill journalists, those who report, kill doctors, and destroy medical facilities. All of this is part of the same pattern, which is, to my mind, a genocidal pattern.
Yeah, we had Physicians for Human Rights on Saturday's show. Professor Omer Bartov, I'll stop you there. More from the Dean Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the Dean Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University, Professor Omer Bartov. Professor, we were talking about your deduction that it is genocide. Does genocide, unlike in 1945, does it actually matter if someone calls it a genocide? The US NATO powers, now co-genocidal powers, I suppose. I mean, there is no real international law. Karim Khan, he's been on this show, the head of the ICC. I think he's under his own problems, suffering his own legal problems right now. Does it matter?
Well, I think it matters a great deal. There is a genocide convention of 1948, and that convention says that all signatory states, and those include all West European states, the State of Israel, and the United States, all signatory states, if they recognize that genocide is occurring, they have to prevent it from happening, they have to stop it when it's happening, and they have to punish those who carry that out after it happened. That's an obligation in the first part. If they recognize
it. Which they don't.
Correct. And they don't now. They don't now. But so one issue is that because that convention makes it, in a sense, the obligation of signatory states to act when there is a genocide, there's reluctance, of course, to do so. This happened already in 1994, for instance, during the Rwandan genocide, when the United States, thinking that it had that obligation, refused to recognize it as a genocide because it didn't want to get involved again in Africa. So yes, it is. It's true that it's difficult for states to recognize a genocide. partly because they then would have to act. In this case, we are seeing much more than that, because Israel is being acting with total impunity and being supplied with arms and political cover by such countries as Germany and, of course, the United States, that provides it with about 70% or 60 to 70% of all the munitions it gets. So, yes, it's true. But it does not mean that if we end up saying that this was genocide, that means that these states were complicit in carrying it out. And if the ICJ rules that it is genocide, even if it does so belatedly, there are obligations to punish the people who carried it out. And the ICC, the International Criminal Court, can be moved to issue more arrest warrants, more indictments, if the ICJ rules that what happened was genocide. There's another aspect to recognizing a genocide, and that is that it leaves a greater stain on a state than any other crime. Because you could say war crimes might have been carried out by this or that military unit, this or that general. Genocide is something that encompasses the entire society. No one is totally free of it. It could be the Doctors Association, it could be the Bar Association, it could be all kinds of universities, academics, intellectuals. When a country is engaged in genocide, everyone in that country becomes in one way or another complicit. And so that leaves a stain on a country several generations past, as we saw, of course, with the case of Germany. And therefore, while you're right, I mean, the international legal regime is not working right now, but it provides a framework which could eventually, belatedly, of course, but eventually also bring people to account and bring countries, entire states, to account.
Yeah, but I mean, the U.S. doesn't recognize the ICC, and in fact, if the ICC dared even to indict any American official, there's an act which justifies the U.S. invasion of Holland. And it's clear that Sir Keir Starmer of Britain said the term you used, genocide, is inaccurate and unhelpful. Macron said it is not genocide. So they could just continue saying this and... It isn't the point that this multi-million dollar industry of international law used usually to imprison African leaders is over. I mean, it's obviously failed about as regards Yugoslavia, considered in the global south as a NATO war of aggression in the first place, because it never was able to indict any of the so-called criminals in that escapade. It's over for international law, isn't it?
Look, I mean... I would say the following. I would say if it's over, then what would we want it to be replaced by? President Trump would certainly like to replace it by good old 19th century international politics, whereby the most powerful states tell the weaker states what to do. This is what he's now trying apparently to impose on Ukraine, saying here two great powers, Russia and the United States, agree on which borders Ukraine would have. That's the kind of politics that would replace the current rule of international law. So it is definitely damaged, and what has happened with the case of Israel has possibly done its irreparable damage, but I would like us to think what happens if we give up on it. And I think that if we give up on it and go back to that kind of politics, we'll live in a much worse world than we are in now, bad as things are at the moment.
Yeah, you're actually a scholar on Ukraine. I know you've criticized Putin right from the start as regards Ukraine, but what exactly has been going on in Ukraine as far as your understanding as regards support for the Nazis? You've said that the Russians are exploiting this as propaganda. What is the reason? I mean, maybe explain to our audience who Stepan Bandera is, given that Western Europeans are financing the building of these statues that went into overdrive since the coup in 2014.
Yeah, well, okay, so I'll say Stepan Bandera was the leader of the more radical faction of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists in the 1930s. When the Nazis invaded Ukraine, he was actually arrested by them and kept for most of the war in a concentration camp under relatively good conditions. And he was seen subsequently as one of the leaders of Ukrainian liberation, first from Polish rule, that's Western Ukraine, and then from Soviet rule. And he was eventually assassinated by the NKVD in Germany. When Ukraine gained independence in 1991, after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was, especially in Western Ukraine, there was a rise in nationalism there, which had been suppressed for decades by Soviet rule. And yes, there was a celebration of those heroes of national liberation from the 1930s and 40s. The problem was that those same heroes of Ukrainian liberation also collaborated with the Nazis in the murder of the Jews. And I actually wrote about all this conundrum in a book that came out in 2007 called Erased. But one should not, because of that, buy into Putin's argument that he was invading Ukraine to save Ukraine from a Nazi takeover. Or pro-Nazi takeover.
In fairness, the Russians said it was to save those areas of Donetsk which were under bombardment. There was mass killing going on since the 2014 coup. But then how does that end up with a Jewish leader being elected? He's now by long past his election date. He abolished elections, of course. So a Jew like Zelensky gets elected on a peace ticket, albeit funded by an oligarch, Kolomoisky, and he ends up applauding an SS officer in the Canadian Parliament. I wonder, what did you feel when you saw that? Because many around the world who supported Ukraine in this conflict, they couldn't see beyond, they thought it was a Russian talking point. And there is an, what did you think about that? The SS officer being applauded unanimously by the Canadian Parliament. Why did it come to that?
Yeah, I don't know what exactly the Canadian Parliament was thinking, but I can tell you that, at least from what I know about Ukraine at the moment, Ukraine tried to, and especially after by Zelensky, tried to create a more open, a more democratic, a less ethno-nationalist society. It's hard to do that. It's a country that was for decades under Soviet rule. It has all kind of difficult histories, as they call it there, but it was making an attempt to do that. And what Putin saw as a danger was precisely that, that Ukraine was developing, was beginning to show that democracy and open society was possible.
Well, this is the view. Certainly the view of those who supported the coup in 2014.
Correct.
But the fact remains, Professor Jeffrey Sachs of Columbia University, who's been on this program a number of times, former advisor to Antonio Guterres, he talks about the fact that one should not underestimate the Nazi symbolism under Zelensky's reign, especially since the so-called special military operation. And in fact, the power of the Azov battalion has increased massively. What are the dangers of far-right extremists with all these multi-billions of dollars worth of weapons as this conflict hopefully winds down? Who are these groups and what is the history that they trace, which you've obviously delineated in your prior work?
Yeah, look, I mean, there are dangers right now. We don't know what sort of Ukraine will emerge from, hopefully, some kind of peace with Russia, whether it would be more the Ukraine that Zelensky epitomized, I think, which was an open society, also open to examining its own past, or that it would be an ethno-nationalist Ukraine that would be more in the spirit of those nationalists of the 1930s. We don't know yet. What we do know is that this war has certainly given more incentive to the far-right elements in Ukraine. And I think that's one of the dangers, that even if Ukraine comes out of this, it would be a different country. You have to remember that this is not only something that is happening in Ukraine. You look at Germany that has now Alternative für Deutschland, which has 20% of the vote. You see that happening in France, in Britain, in Spain, in Portugal, of course, in Italy. So this rise of these kind of ethno-nationalist populists who all link themselves to a fascist past, all of them, you know, refer to moments of glory in, as they see it, in the past of those countries, we have to understand where that is coming. But I think that none of that whatsoever makes Putin's invasion of Ukraine legal. It is an illegal invasion of a country. And if he succeeds in that, if he succeeds in gaining enough influence through that, then he's moving on. And he's moving on directly to the Baltic states, which have large Russian minorities.
Well, no, but it's not that new, is it? Because we know Kosovo, the example of Kosovo, which the Western European states recognized in the 1990s. So there's nothing new about this kind of ending of international law.
No.
I mean, is this going to feature in... I wanted to hear about your next year's book, Israel, What Went Wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, is surely a part of it going to be that this international order that was created after the Genocide Convention of in the 40s and so on, it's over now. It is... big powers now, and obviously the BRICS nations are trying to forge a new international legal consensus that protects them from the predations of these hegemonic Western superpowers.
Yeah, so my book, Israel, What Went Wrong, is focused more on the case of Zionism and the state of Israel. My argument is, or my question really, is how is it that Zionism, which started off in the 1880s as a movement of liberation, of emancipation, of appeal to humanitarianism by Jews who were, of course, attacked as a minority across Europe with more and more violence against them, how is it that that movement became, after the establishment of the state, into the ideology, the state ideology, an ideology that increasingly became ethno-nationalist, expansionist, militaristic, and now also racist. That to me is a tragedy, but also one that has to be understood. How does it happen that such an ideology of a minority becomes one of oppressing minorities, of liberation, one of oppression? That's the story that I try to tell in this book.
Professor Omer Bartov, we may have you on before the book is published even. Thank you so much once again.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by UK-US-EU armed genocide. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.